I'm Afua Hirsch.
I'm Peter Frankopan.
And in our podcast, Legacy, we explore the lives of some of the biggest characters in history.
This season, we're exploring the life of Cleopatra.
An iconic life full of romances, sieges, and tragedy. But who was the real Cleopatra? It feels like her story's been told by others with their own agenda for centuries.
But her legacy is enduring, and so we're going to dive into how her story has evolved all the way up to today.
I am so excited to talk about Cleopatra, Peter.
Love Cleopatra.
She is an icon.
She's the most famous woman in antiquity. It's got to be up there with the most famous woman of all time.
But I think there's a huge gap between how familiar people are with the idea of her compared to what they actually know about her life and character.
So for pyramids, Cleopatra and Cleopatra's nose.
Follow Legacy now wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can binge entire seasons early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Down to Snow's History. I'm enjoying my first day of voluntary isolation in my own home, which, for a podcast host and occasional writer, feels much like a normal day. Except this time I've got children at home. Actually, I've got my youngest, Orla, on my lap now. How are you doing, Orla?
Good. I'm just doing perfect. Blah, blah, blah.
Well, perfect, I think, is an exaggeration. I think Orla has inherited the Snow family broadcasting hyperbolic tendency, but she's behaving adequately. Let's just say that. Adequately, Orla. How about that?
I'm adequately. Blah, blah, blah.
Right. So I like the way she ends everything in. I like the way you end everything in blah, blah, blah. That's what you think your daddy does for a living. And actually, sometimes I think she's probably right. If you wish to go and take advantage of our unbelievable sale on historyhit.tv, new programs being added all the time, spent Monday, just before the lockdown, filming at Windsor Castle. Some great programmes there for you to watch when they come out on historyhit.tv. You can go and use the code POD3, POD3. You get a month for free, and then you get 3 months for just £1, euro or dollar for each of those 3 months. And frankly, who knows where we're going to be in 4 months' time, everyone. So that doesn't sound like a bad trade. You can watch the world's best history channel for 4 months for just £3, euros or dollars by using the code POD3 historyhit.tv. You will see interviews such as this one. I recorded this interview with Ed West just as the coronavirus was getting into its stride. We discussed his political affiliation, which was somewhat unusual for someone of his generation. He's an avowed conservative, and we had a fun chat about why he thinks conservatives are right, but perhaps also why they're destined to keep losing. His book, Small Men on the Wrong Side of History, is out now. Enjoy this podcast. Please go and check out historyhit.tv and use the code POD3.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
This is unfashionable. You're self-identifying a conservative. Yeah. You're a young, otherwise normal millennial guy. What is a conservative?
I should say I'm actually just the last year is a Generation X, but yeah, I'm
so
fairly
am I,
young.
So am I, but let's
I suppose the point of my book was a form of self-therapy in a way, because most of my contemporaries, my age group, are obviously of the centre-left, progressive left, university-educated, London-based. And I've always been slightly different. And as I've got older, I've always been a bit more conservative. But as I've got older, I just assumed everyone else had become more conservative with me, because that's always how it happened. And as I got older, in fact, the opposite. Most people are actually, on social issues, becoming more liberal, more left-wing. And that suddenly occurred to me as I hit my mid-30s, that there was actually something quite different happening, a change in our culture. And the more I looked at it in actual studies, and both in the States and Britain, the old thing about people becoming more conservative in their 30s is no longer happening. I mean, there's a big change. So the kind of spur for this was finally, I'd been working on this book for a while, then when 2017 came, and the Corbyn lost, but Tories did so badly amongst young people, and not just young people, but quite middle-aged people our age, and
prime of life sort of time.
Prime of life people. And they were all still completely repulsed by conservatives. And they didn't like Corbyn either. And he managed to basically sabotage my book by massively losing 2 years later. But I suppose the essence of conservatism is, it's a mixture between a sort of psychological makeup and a sort of political ideology that dates back to Edmund Burke, who I come back to. So it's a mixture of that and a sort of predisposition towards a certain, I suppose, pessimism is a core part. A belief in the limits of human nature. You know, I start with Cassandra the ancient Greek myth said, you know, by the way, the Greeks are going to destroy us. Don't listen to that idea. They don't want peace. It's all disaster. And, you know, she was right. And so since then, you know, pessimists have always been quite annoying to be around, but they're often quite right. So right down to the modern age, you know, from the French Revolution to communism, and to a certain extent, modern progressive left ideas, which I think have a utopian...
Well, but let me pick you up on that, because that's weird, isn't it? Because we all have a tendency to be a bit pessimistic, but actually, but look at the reality of what we've done. I don't want to be Whiggish here, buddy, but we are sitting in a city with an unimaginable quality of life compared to 200 years ago, unimaginably low, young men, sadly, still too often stabbing each other, but unimaginably small numbers compared to, you know, medieval Oxford, famously from that study. Healthcare outcomes, extraordinary. We're flying around the world. I mean, there are big problems, but you can see, you can't say that pessimism, people have been right. If you're pessimistic in 1780, you've got the whole world's going shit. That's not entirely accurate, is it?
No, of course. I mean... It comes down to, I mean, Burke was the original pessimist. Burke was pessimistic about the French Revolution, and he turned out to be completely right. And there are times when pessimism is needed, because the natural human disposition is towards optimism in some sense, you know, because otherwise life would just be unbearable. And to go back to the Greek myth, you know, the Pandora and Pandora's box, like hope leaves last, because we all need hope. That's why we embark on great visions and projects. And that's why you need... conservatives, pessimists say, actually, I don't think that's a very good idea. You know, they don't think beheading the king and just starting this completely from scratch is a great idea. So it's the Whig history is obviously, I mean, you're a Whig and there's, you know, nothing wrong with that. And you're going from, you know, barbarism and sort of medievalism towards this great new sunny uplands. The conservative, I suppose, would say, well, once we become wealthy, yes, we become more liberal. That's the direction of travel. I mean, and I think that's the major driver of why we've become more liberal since the 60s. We're just much, much more wealthy.
Okay.
I would say it goes that direction rather than the other way around.
Okay, let's park social liberalism for a second. And I want to get back to, like, so the political conservatism. So your Burke, the idea that time-hallowed institutions are better than the ones that we can just dream up on the back of a fag packet in Costa.
Yeah.
What is interesting about the modern world is that Trump and Johnson are not conservatives, right? I mean, by that definition, are they? I mean, they're just burn it all down, double the national debt. I mean, they're kind of... Isn't that part of the problem of the words that we're using now?
I would say, I mean, Boris is probably more of a Whig than anything. I might say he's a liberal conservative. Trump is more, I mean, he's such a psychologically interesting person that it's hard to say. But he has a certain revolutionary aspect to him. Yeah. It's a kind of revolutionary conservatism, which is, I think, this is what I deal in later chapters, when sort of institutions are core to conservatives, but when they tend to move to the left, institutions become... sort of captured by liberals, and that's what happens in the English-speaking world. Most of our higher institutions are overwhelmingly liberal. They would vote Remain. Everyone would tend to be Democrat in the States and left-leaning over here. Then conservatives tend to become anti-institutions, become kind of unmoored. They become sort of revolutionary conservatives, which is a bit of what populism is about, especially in Trump's thing. I mean, Trump and the whole Trumpism thing is partly about sort of burning down the whole institutions. It's because they're just infested with...
That doesn't feel very Burkean, though, does it?
No, that's not very Burkean, and that sort of forms a split in conservative thought, because, you know, some conservatives are more the status quo ones, and this came in Brexit as well. So I started off as quite pro-Brexit beforehand, because the idea of national sovereignty, but as it gone on, there came sort of the division amongst a lot of conservatives, because I'm more of a status quo conservative, and I always think, well, however bad things are, whoever follows are probably going to be even worse. And once they start become, you sort of have this sort of radical populist talk of, you know, attacking Goldman Sachs. That sort of unnerves me, because I just think these guys are sort
poor
of,
guys. Right.
Yeah, but saying, like them, but they're institutions, and the alternative is going to be worse, right? So some of the Brexiteers are sort of status quo conservatives, but some of them are actually quite, you know, radical, revolutionary, want a new thing.
So that is
the kind of contradiction.
I was a Remainer, right? And I'm walking around going, I feel like the only conservative in the room. I'm walking around a country that's one of the richest countries in the world, has achieved a level of peace from an active insurgency that was going on in part of this country until the 1990s. Where there's work to do, but living standards are among the highest in the world. It's people like living here. People satisfaction index is really high. Why are we torturing it all? Like, you know, it's right, a bunch of small C conservative remainder.
Both sides, in a way, think they're trying to stop a revolutionary change. I mean, both Brexiteers will say, like, we want our country back because all the changes that have happened to our country. Well, curiously, Remainers always say, I want my country back. And I think that's something to do with the difference of the psychology of the two. But they both talked exactly, you know, the way that UKIP voters talked in 2011, is how a lot of Remainers talk in 2018. You know, why have these guys changed everything? Everything's going fine, right? So,
okay, so
I mean, it's often in politics, people think don't realise the other side are actually thinking similar things about them that they're thinking of. So, and that's kind of the paradox of our politics.
So do you think that people that were conservatives, from Burke onwards, so you got the Duke of Wellington in the 1820s going, the British Constitution is perfect. He stood up in the House of Commons and it ended his premiership. Because it was what we have inherited, it seems to work, let's not smash it up. Do you think, from the title of your book, do you think conservatives are sort of destined to lose out to this natural optimism and naivety and utopianism that the rest of us all have?
I think I don't know. I think it comes and goes. And some issues, things move back. I mean, with education, when I was growing up, education was very progressive, much radical, and that's moved back a lot. And on that issue, progressives have sort of conceded. I mean, in the state, particularly the issues of crime have gone back a little bit. You know, in the 60s, everyone had very liberal ideas about, you know, we just put fewer people in prison, everything we find. I mean, almost no one in the states really believes that now. I think another issue is the idea of human nature, which has been very influenced in the late 20th century by blank slate ideas, which is behind a lot of progressivism, that we're basically all formed by the environment around us rather than our genes. I think that's coming unstuck a lot. I sort of allude to that, but it's sort of outside my area of science, so I don't really want to get stuck into it. But I mean, that's the Rousseau kind of idea that we're all, victims of society. I think that's swinging back as well. So some conservative ideas do win out, but I think the main problem is because liberalism tends to correlate with openness, which also, so obviously the art, that's the main reason why the arts will always be left of centre. Now, since the days of Shelley, the arts has been, particularly, has been very sort of, you know, left wing. And so the liberal story gets told much better, you know, in plays, in novels, in films. So their sort of story is the one that sort of gets remembered by the conservatives. I mean, look at, you know, the idea of our 60s. Even though the liberals in the States sort of basically lost most of the arguments, like, you know, people voted Nixon, most people hated, and the word liberal became a dirty word over there. All the films we remembered, all the plays basically tell the liberal narrative, right? No, there aren't any. I mean, maybe like from that period, Death Wish is the only like conservative film there is, but that came at a period of huge fear about crime, so that was sort of unusual.
But when you look, I don't want to be all panglossian, but when you look at the last 200 years since Burke, conservatives what is the point of conservatives? They can warn and slow the pace of change, but ultimately, it's hard to think of a field in which they've successfully. I guess you could argue that they're conservatives, like someone like Peel, is somebody who respects the past, is up for reform and change, but with a sort of duty obligation to bring the best bits of the past with them.
Sure, I mean, I wouldn't say conservatism is lost. I mean, Britain is the most politically conservative in the true sense that our constitution is pragmatic, it's make do, and that's why any
sort of, it's what we've done before.
Yeah, so while the constitutions of other states like France are basically theoretical, they're utilitarian, and they are sort of unconservative. And well, the British state has been fantastically successful the last 200 years. So it's a sort of argument for conservative views. I mean, not just compared to the terrible disasters of communism and fascism and all those other kind of things, but even you know, the French example. I mean, unfortunately, now the British state seems to be going through a sort of a crisis point because we don't know. You know, it's all been a sort of gentleman's agreement up to this point, and now we don't know what's going on.
Now the gentlemen have left the room.
But, you know, Britain has been conservatively ruled, and, I mean, even our our Labour tradition is very small-C conservative, and was until...
Attlee was a kind of conservative figure.
Yeah, and then a lot of former Labour voters sort of very nostalgic about that idea of the small-C sort of social conservatism of Labour.
And yet Britain has been kind of transformed beyond all recognition from 100 years ago, right? So you're comfortable with the present. You don't wish that we were living in a sort of Edwardian social setting, or I mean,
No, I mean because nothing beats medical technology. Nothing beats
dentistry.
Dating
apps,
you know,
very useful.
Infant mortality is a third of what it was even when I was growing up. So I mean, there are huge changes and progress, but I don't think these necessarily depend on liberal ideas. Liberal ideas, I think, tend to come from them because when we're more comfortable and less fearful, we tend to become naturally more liberal. I mean, one of the interesting things is, one of the theories, I mean, I don't go into it because it's like with psychology, so many of the ideas are now being blown apart. But You know, one of the theories was that is to do with sort of germs, and the more susceptible to germs we are, the more conservative, because the more sort of fearful we are of outsiders and things. And so as all our germs have been defeated over the 20th century, we become ultra liberal. So that will test the theory the next few weeks if things get really terrible.
This is After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds and the Paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds and the Paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Do you feel that to be a conservative is to be on the, you know, on the, why do you feel it's on the wrong side of history? Is it because of the dominance of liberal storytellers and artists and creatives?
Yes, I think, you know, the quotes from Barack Obama, he was talking about Al-Qaeda, who obviously I'm not comparing the modern conservative movement to, but, you know, I just list all the, if you just wanted to list all the cool people in politics and, you know, the films and in culture generally, they tend to be on the left because they are better at telling a story and better at being cool. So, but it's also a reference to the basic Christian elements of the left. So, you know, modern liberalism is basically a heresy of Christianity, and lots of people have come up with this analogy up to Tom Holland's brilliant book about Christianity. So they've inherited this Christian idea that things are going better until the final days when, you know, all good will triumph over evil. And communists believe this, and liberalism in its modern form sort of believes this, and that's why they talk about the wrong side of history, about conservatives. Their argument is like, we're going to win, you're going to look like a bigot in the future, whatever your argument is, you know, you're going to be the loser. And that's where you come to, oh, why do you have so many women in your cabinet? You know, Trudeau's argument, oh, it's because it's 2015, it's that sort of argument, it's just the current year, so we have to be progressive. So I'm sort of doing that sort of tongue-in-cheek, say, okay, yeah, right, we're the baddies, that's our role in this story. But I think it's not an entirely fair one.
I remember Lord Salisbury, who was a famous conservative prime minister, who
great
said,
man.
Well, I thought you might be a fan. And he goes, it's best, given that when you do things, they're likely to go wrong, it's best not doing them at all. Yeah. But isn't that's conservative from the point of view of an extraordinarily wealthy man at the apogee of British political power, which was itself at the apogee of its own kind of imperial domination. So isn't there a problem with conservatism? It sort of depends, it very much depends, well, I mean, well, I suppose all politics, where you're sitting. I mean, it's...
Of course. Yeah. I think he has certain, I don't know, I mean, Salisbury, one of the things, I don't know if I like him ironically or if it's now non-ironically, but I think his thing about, you know, change is always for the worse is, I mean, again, after the referendum, I felt this, like, you know, how much worse would it have been if we had not done that? I mean, that's my view of a lot of things, especially innovation in politics. A lot of the time we could just, like, let's do nothing and things will, you know, be better.
But isn't it funny, like, am I making the same mistake Salisbury made? Like, am I saying, oh, well, modern world's brilliant, and in 200 years' time they'll laugh at us because they think, look at those idiots, they were still living with chronic, you know, massive social inequality, and they had poor health outcomes, they had mental health problems. So shouldn't we be trying more actively? I mean, why am I right about Remain and why was Salisbury right at that time? Because it looks absurd to us now. Late 19th century Britain was in, you know, need of dire reform and development.
But you measure a society by what it's inherited, I think. I mean, and so people, the Victorians, this is Victorian Britain is always used as an example of how terrible it was. But look at the society the Victorians inherited; it was appalling, and the one they left behind was incredibly improved. I mean, it was so much better in every way. They'd managed to reduce all the bad indices of life. And made a much much healthier, happier society. And that was essentially a pretty conservative one. So I think you have to just judge people by what they inherit, you know, so that they can do the best they can. I think there are lots of progressive ideas. I think in the future, people 100 years might laugh at a lot. But, I mean, the fact is, I don't even dare about laugh about them now. Yeah. Because in the same way, in the 16th century, you don't laugh at the church.
Have you got any examples of conservative politicians you admire who left better situations behind their inheritance?
Oh, Kenneth Clark, definitely. I mean, everyone my generation got a job because he was a good... But, you know, he's a slightly controversial figure, I suppose, these days. He's divisive between because of that issue. You know, he was never going to agree with his party. I mean, the interesting thing about politics is, you know, we always think at the time, oh, who are these... sort of pygmies. I remember in the mid-90s, everyone thought that our politicians, oh, they're all idiots. And now, looking back, they seem like giants compared to the people now. But maybe in like 30 years' time, when who knows...
Well, the Ed Miliband, the Ed Miliband fan club is in resurgence, isn't
Miliband might be back, you never know. So things can always get worse, that's my message.
Things can get worse. But what I find fascinating about conservatism as it's used on the internet now and in North America... and liberalism, is the words have almost detached any kind of meaning. Like, to be a conservative in North America is to be kind of... have strong views about women's reproductive rights and gender identification. Like, why are these things... And yet not really care about smashing up constitutional norms. Like, is that a thing? Is that a problem for you? Like, the words... Are the definitions going... Is it impossible to write this book, surely?
I don't know. I think, I mean, abortion is... America is much more religious than Britain. Abortion is a big issue. I think it is a genuine conservative issue, if you believe that. I suppose... I mean, abortion is an interesting one because it became... It's the one kind of cultural issue in America where the right actually haven't lost. Like, they've maintained the same state in popular opinion. The popular opinion, you know, issue and beliefs on that have not changed over, like, 30, 40 years. While on every single other issue, conservatives have sort of hemorrhaged support. And, you know, the liberals have basically won. Generally, I mean, conservatism is all politics is basically an alliance between lots of disparate groups, right? So in the States, for a while, it was a kind of mixture of sort of Reaganites, small states, you know, economic liberals and these social conservatives. And that's with Trump has sort of smashed that up. There's a sort of shift going on now and there. It's been called the Great Realignment. I don't know who coined that phrase, but I think it's a great one. And I think, I mean, the same thing's happened in Britain, basically. You see the Conservative Party is becoming much more working class. We don't really have the same social conservatism because we don't really have the same amount of religion. But, you know, the right-wing party is becoming much more economically statist and culturally conservative, while the left-wing party becomes much more economically, like, right-wing, while being socially liberal. And that party becomes the party, basically, of the elites, just as the Democrats now have all the wealthiest districts in the States. So, you know, Trump is sort of a conservative, but he's a sort of populist conservative. I mean, you know, it's hard to talk about political ideology with him because he's not... I mean, I don't think he's read a book before, so, I mean, he's not...
He wants everyone to watch Sunset Boulevard and Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, exactly. So this is where the comparisons of Boris, sort of, I think, are, you know, not fair, because Boris Johnson is, whatever his sins, he does think about things, he's well-read... He does have an ideology, I think. And I think his London mayor, time as mayor, was probably his truest ideology. I think he's a sort of liberal conservative. To a certain extent, he's pragmatic, so he thinks this is the way things are going, and that's...
So what's the big realignment? So the great realignment is now between... Is it that... So Theresa May hinting at it and Donald Trump talking about globalists. Is this idea of people that are willing to accept these gigantic changes in terms of movement of people...
Right,
so it's about, ideas, pan national culture.
It's about it's globalization versus, you know, nationalism. Those are the big divisive point. Where in the past it might have been economics. I mean, class was the big issue. It was, you know, in the past the British politics was about a sort of middle class alliance between liberals and conservatives opposed to a sort of socialist working class. And in 1945, people in Britain voted incredibly strictly on class lines. The overwhelming majority of working class people voted Labour. Most middle class people voted Tory. Now that's completely changed around. More working class people vote Tory and more middle class. You know, if you go to nice areas of London now, everyone has a Labour flag outside them. And you can predict someone's opinion. And just as if you go to many, you know, young working class guys in particular, will vote for the Tory party, because politics is about identity. It's essentially, it's a kind of continuation of religion almost.
But that is a problem for the conservative narrative though, isn't it? Because then if the conservative big C is just not being, I mean, what if it is just about reimposing movement of, you know, reimposing barriers to trade and movement of people and ideas and students? I mean, that this is something that Britain, if Britain stretching all the way back to the 17th century has been a sort of entrepot of trade and ideas and things going on and armies going off conquering.
Sure, but I mean, free movement of people is a very recent... Britain has never been...
London was always this like incredibly dynamic city full of immigrants, full of people.
It's always had very small numbers of immigrants relative to post 97. I mean, that is a new thing. That is modern world.
But if the remedy, quote unquote, to that is to... is to build quite a different kind of British state. Doesn't feel very conservative, though, does it? I mean, it's not...
It depends what you mean by conservatism. I would say there's a split, right? So there's the conservative paradox. I think it was David Willetts. I mean, all ideologies have complete paradox to that because people want everything, right? So he is saying that the free market, sort of neoliberal economics is, you know, I don't like the phrase, but that's what's used. They do sort of destroy everything conservatives hold dear. I mean, they make change. They make radical change. Everything becomes different. And this is, so if you go back to all those radical movements like the Luddites, they were basically conservative. They didn't want change. They wanted to keep their old jobs. They didn't want this mechanization. So under Thatcher, Britain became far, far more liberal because the city of London became dominant. And there's nothing more liberal or liberalizing than finance. It's like the free movement of money. If you go into financial worlds now, you know, briefly, I, for various reasons, worked at a finance company, and these, you know, they were just devastated by Brexit. They're all, I mean, for financial and emotional reasons, right? Because they are an international community. They have overwhelmingly liberal values. There's like one Brexiteer in the company, and he was like in his 60s. And it was considered sort of like a darling eccentric because it was so unusual. I mean, that is the most liberal world imaginable, and that's all down to Thatcher's revolution. So that's the kind of contradiction at the heart of conservatism. And I think Brexit is going to bring huge difficulties to that because there are two visions of Brexit, right? There's the Whig vision, which is like we're sort of buccaneering. There's a lot of, you know, pirate talk about we're going to go on the high seas and, you know, and basically it's the 19th century liberal vision of free trade. Well, then there's a sort of more Tory Brexit, which is basically, like, you know, it's like people want to live and retire to Hobbiton, to the Shire. They want like a... their own community.
It's like the 1945 Labour consensus.
Exactly, right.
So stuff made in Britain.
The fact that, you know, the 1945 Labour were very Eurosceptic and for very similar reasons, and they would fit perfectly in with modern day, the sort of, I don't know, the Red Wall, New Tories who are all going that way. So these two visions of Brexit, right, it will take a very skilled politician to bridge those and satisfy both camps. I don't know how it's going
to
happen.
Yeah. So we're getting caught up with contemporary politics. So coming back essentially to what conservatism is and why you are one. What is it? So it's, in essence, it's a sense that the world is fine as it is. Change may bring catastrophic results.
Right. No. I mean, like conservatism. So to go back to the beginning with a basic sort of description of what it is. And the main difference people have between conservatives, what they misunderstand is they mix it up with what Jerry Muller, the American academic, calls orthodoxy. So orthodoxy means like nothing should change because it's a preordained sort of almost always a religious reasons, like this is how things are, you must not question that. So conservatism has always embraced change to a certain extent. I mean, then Burke says, you know, society that doesn't change is unable to improve itself. And conservatives just believe like institutional proof. So if an institution is there, it's giving some proof that it has a reason for it's there. So the burden of proof is on the people to change it. I mean, this is why like Blair was so disliked by the sort of a certain section of conservative thought, because he loved sort of the meddling instinct as they wanted to get rid of the House of Lords, change everything. It's like, and you know, like it's fine, like it's been there for a long time, so like why change it because of your, you know, your first priority is this doesn't make sense in theory, so I have to change it. So conservatives believe that the burden of proof on people changing stuff has to be, well, you have to prove why your you know, new world is going to be better, because a lot of the time that's not going to be the case, right? And just a general principle, you know, like, again, I don't want to go into biology because a sort of scientifically literate conservative using those analogies is always a bad idea. But, you know, in evolution, small tiny mutations are usually often an advantage. That's how evolution works. But huge mutations are almost always terrible. They catastrophic results. Huge change, by its definition, in history has always been bad, almost always. While I think, you know, small, tiny, incremental changes are the way forward. So it's basically, I mean, someone said, you know, conservatism is basically liberalism with a speed limit on, so.
I love that. Well, thank you very much indeed. Your book is Small Men on the Wrong Side of History.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ed West.
I feel the hand of history on our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished and liquidated.
One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world.
He tells us what is possible, not just in the pages of history books, but in our own lives as well.
I have faith in you.
Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favor to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favor, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there, law of the jungle out there. And I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.